Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 2nd of July. We were alerted to a New Republic story yesterday by a listener, and by golly, we're on it today. The New Republic cover story, Who Lincoln Was and Was Not, the Images and Illusions of This Momentous Bicentennial Year. The author said that the announcements in last year's publisher's catalogs that a flood of new books would accompany Lincoln's bicentennial gave him an opportunity to evaluate the state of Lincoln's scholarship, in part by pointing to the writings of those historians, past and present, who insist on evaluating Lincoln seriously as a political creature. The difficulty is that an entirely new fashion in the histories of Lincoln seems to have arisen, which further diminishes the importance of party politics and government in his career. And this new fashion, which is really a retrieval and an expansion of older lines of interpretation, takes for granted that Lincoln rose to a surpassing greatness. In one way or another, the fashion locates Lincoln's chief distinction in his literary sophistication and his empathetic powers, making only passing glances at his political astuteness. And our guest believes that we should be looking at his political astuteness, and does in the very lengthy article in the New Republic. He takes a look at a number of books, including Lincoln, President-elect, Abraham Lincoln and the Great Secession Winter, by Harold Holzer, Abraham Lincoln, A Life by Michael Burlingame, A. Lincoln, A Biography, Ronald White, the Lincoln Anthology, Great Writers on His Life and Legacy, also edited by Harold Holzer, Lincoln, The Biography of a Writer, Fred Kaplan, and Lincoln on Race and Slavery, an important one by Henry Louis Gates Jr., Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln by John Stauffer. And so we're going to be talking about this first hour of our program today. Our guest has a really interesting biography. He is Professor Robert Wilentz, and he is a professor of U.S. social and political history at Princeton University. He has written The Rise of Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, which was published in 2005. His most recent book is The Age of Reagan, A History 1974-2008, A Reconsideration of U.S. Politics Since Watergate. He's a contributing editor to The New Republic and Newsweek, lectures frequently, and has written many, many articles in many esteemed publications in this country. And he's currently, we have to talk to him about this eventually, completing a book tentatively entitled Bob Dylan in America, A Historical and Cultural Interpretation of Dylan's Life and Work. And he is in his spare time historian in residence at Bob Dylan's official website, which we'll give you toward the end of this show. So we welcome phone calls for Professor Robert Wilentz. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that, and the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Robert Wilentz, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, it's great to be here. Yeah. Just one little thing.
Yeah.
I go by Sean rather than Robert, S-E-A-N. It's my middle name.
I'm sorry. I tried to figure that out because in some places you're Robert and some places you're Sean.
No one can quite figure it out, but there it is. Okay.
So we call you Sean then.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Hello. Thanks.
Hello.
Thanks so much for being with us. Well, we're doing a trip to Springfield, so this is perfect. You know, the more we can talk about Lincoln and getting prepared for this trip to Springfield, the better, I think.
Right.
What a year to go there. And I love the books that you've selected here. What about his place in history? You start the article by talking about whether or not he was the best president, and you do say that the past three generations of historians have agreed that he probably was the best, and Franklin Pierce was one of the worst. Can you talk about the two of them and their time in history, and would you agree with those rankings?
Well, first of all, I would certainly agree. Franklin Pierce was a New Hampshire Democrat who was elected to the presidency at a time when basically the Southern slaveholders had taken over the Democratic Party. Pierce was one of those who was considered sort of soft on slavery and on the slaveholders. But in order to get Northern votes, the Democrats had to look to Northern politicians. So Pierce was one of them. And I mean, during his presidency, it was not a particularly happy one. He wasn't a particularly happy man, but it was a difficult time. And basically, the sectional controversies only deepened during his time as president from 1853 to 1857. I mean, it's during that period that the whole Bleeding Kansas controversy turns violent, and basically Pierce was siding with the South, although he never quite came out and said so. But, well, sometimes he did. But he didn't do anything to stave off the controversy. In fact, he only made it worse. And certainly on the issues that we now care about, issues of slavery and its expansion, and that Lincoln cared about, slavery and its expansion, Pierce was on the wrong side. Lincoln, during the same period, was going through something of a transformation. I mean, he had been a very staunch, loyal Whig party politician, which meant he was part of a coalition of Northern conservatives and reformers and Southern planters that had opposed Andrew Jackson, actually, going back to the 1830s. But that party was falling apart, basically, because of the slavery issue in the 1850s. And gradually, between 1854 and 1856, Abraham Lincoln became a Republican and became one of the leading Republicans in the country, the first mass political party dedicated to anti-slavery principles in the history of the world, actually. And Lincoln was a leader of the Illinois Republican Party after 1856, and he ended up famously debating during his run for the Senate in 1858 against Stephen Douglas, and was elected president in 1860, and went on to become, I think, certainly the best president this country's ever had.
Mm-hmm. When Pierce ran for president in 1852, you write, Lincoln campaigned against him. Mm-hmm. The cause of the Whig Party was extremely feeble in Illinois that year, and Lincoln gives a speech, a long speech, where it took him 2 days to deliver, which is amazing. But the speech deserves to be remembered, you say, in these days of Lincoln idolatry, because it can be disturbing reading to anyone inclined to worship Father Abraham.
Right. Right.
We don't remember that speech, right?
Well, but very few people do.
Right.
It's a speech that he gives against Pierce. And what's interesting about it is along the way, he makes all sorts of accusations against Pierce, and he accuses him of coming out against the fugitive slave law, which had been passed in 1850, in a bid for Northern votes. He was trying to act anti-slavery. He was talking outside of both sides of his mouth. He was a flip-flopper, is the way we would put it, as a bid to get votes. But the image he uses is of Pierce as a mulatto coming from mixed political parentage. And when you read that part of the speech, it sounds kind of weirdly disturbing, coming from a guy who was so anti-slavery, mm-hmm. To be accusing the man he opposes for the presidency as a mulatto, and therefore to be almost laughed at. It doesn't exactly ring with the Abraham Lincoln that people idolize these days.
Mm-hmm. And so it shows that he was using politics, that he was politically astute, that it was going to serve him well to use that line of attack?
Well, I mean, it was along the way. I mean, it was sort of a casual toss-off. It was very much in the language of the day. It was a kind of offhand, mildly racist comment, given in the heat of a political campaign. That kind of language would recede in his own political talk after 1854, when he came out as a Republican, much more anti-slavery. But by the same token, Lincoln was very much a man of his times, so he wasn't, immune to all of that. Things that we would consider to be horrifying were not so horrifying in the 1850s. The main point of, though, and the point I try to make in the piece, is that this was essentially a political speech, a political remark. He is using this not to make some commentary about, moral philosophy or about race relations or about anything other than the fact that Franklin Pierce ought not to be elected president because he's a flip-flopper.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's important. I mean, Abraham Lincoln is essentially a politician. Above all else, he is a politician. He is a politician for his entire life. He knows how to get things done in public as a politician. And that, I think, is something that we've begun to forget as Americans.
Mm-hmm. And yet, the modern interpretation of him, and I fell victim to this at times too, I adore his language, I adore his speeches, I love reading them aloud, is that he is Shakespeare, he is Jesus.
Yeah, well, Jesus, yeah. that's a matter of faith, both him and for Jesus Christ. But the main thing, I think, is that yes, we look at his writings. We read some of his writings anyway, a few of his writings, some of the speeches he gives in the 1850s, the second inaugural as president above all, perhaps, the Gettysburg Address, famously. I mean, he had an ability to bring together his own immersion in Shakespeare and various English poets and all sorts of things that he read, and to refine his own language, and adding to that his lawyer's logic, his ability to think like a lawyer, and refine speeches and refine his ideas in such a way that he could present them in a very, very moving fashion. And when we look back at them, you can't help but be moved by his description of slavery, for example, in the second inaugural, or the Gettysburg Address. I mean, we can quote that till the day goes, you know, all day long.
Mm-hmm.
But the point that I'm trying to make is that what's great about those speeches isn't simply the language, or what's important about it isn't simply the language, but the political uses that he made of them. I mean, he didn't give these speeches innocent of politics, and he uses language. He used language both eloquent and more ordinary, more mundane, towards political ends. And there's nothing wrong with that. It doesn't cheapen it in any way. But I think that if we remember or if we think of Abraham Lincoln as a great man because he was a writer, I think we miss something. He was a writer, yes, and he was a political leader, and he was a politician. He was all of those things. And even his greatest, most eloquent words weren't necessarily anything to be able to, anything that he could count on in getting anything done. For example, the first inaugural address, which is remembered for all kinds of fine phrases, did not manage to accomplish what it set out to accomplish, which was to forestall Southern secession. I mean, and forestall the crisis that was brewing in Charleston Harbor that led to the firing on Fort Sumter. He bids in that inaugural address, he bids the South to come to its senses, to reject secession. Well, it didn't work.
Didn't happen.
It didn't happen. In fact, the most effective document that he wrote as President of the United States, in my view, was the Emancipation Proclamation,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, was the first big step, as Frederick Douglass said, towards ending the enormity of slavery. But boy, you cannot find a less eloquent document literarily.
Right.
One great historian, Richard Hofstadter, said that it had all the moral grandeur of a bill of lading. it's a legalistic text. It happened to be backed up by the force of the Union Army, which gave it extra power. But, you know, he was a great writer, but sometimes a great writing is not enough to get things done, sometimes. And sometimes it doesn't work. It doesn't even necessarily mean that you're right if you can write beautifully. But he could do so. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. And he had other tools at his command.
Mm-hmm. And when did it work? When did the force of words result in wonderful things?
Well, I think mostly in the run-up to the presidency or to the election of 1860. I mean, Lincoln is you know, something of an old political hack in the Whig Party as of 1854. He's a very much a local figure. He's very much, you know, an Illinois politician. But between about 1856 and 1860, he emerges as a great standard bearer for the Republican Party. And I think the speeches that he gives in his debates with Douglas in 1858, his very, very powerful speech that he gives in New York City in February 1860, the so-called Cooper Union or Cooper Institute address. I mean, I think in those particular speeches, he brought himself to the attention of not just the leaders of the Republican Party, but to the nation at large as someone who was a real heavyweight, a very thoughtful person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that those speeches, as much as anything, got him the nomination. He himself said that the Cooper Union address is what really got him the nomination of the Republican Party down the line. I think there's something to be said for that, and I think that those were really very effective. Moving on, though, I mean, the first inaugural, as we said, didn't succeed. The Gettysburg Address, which was designed to dedicate a cemetery, well, it succeeded in dedicating a cemetery, but it didn't, you know, prevent him from a few months later suffering a real tumble in public esteem. He nearly, you know, it wasn't clear that he was even going to win re-election until Sherman's victories in Atlanta, mm-hmm. in, you know, fairly late in the game. So, I mean, the Gettysburg Address is much more important well after the fact than it was at the time. Hmm. And then the second inaugural, which is, you know, one of the great passages, one of the great literary efforts in all of American history, as far as I'm concerned. It's a beautiful, beautiful speech.
It is.
But the fact was, he was murdered shortly thereafter. And ironically, actually, I mean, the speech basically looks back on the war. The Union Army's about to win. The Union cause is about to succeed. He says this was a war that everyone knew was somehow about slavery. And he describes in very eloquent biblical terms, really, his own feelings, his own sense of what this all means in religious terms as well as in political terms. And he describes slavery, and he says that, you know, even if drop of blood that was shed under slavery, every mark of the lash, we would have to repay all of those in fighting this war in human sacrifice. That will be the Lord's will. I mean, it's a very powerful section. I can't do it justice here on the radio, but that portion actually was not remembered down the line. What was remembered, really into our own time, was the passage that came just after that, where he talks about, you know, with malice towards none, with charity for all, in trying to bid some kind of sense of rapprochement between the North and the South once the war was over. Well, he certainly meant that, but that wasn't. It was taken in ways that he didn't mean to make him into a kind of defender of the South in the aftermath of the Civil War. D.W. Griffith, the famous movie director who came out with Birth of a Nation, made Lincoln a kind of hero of the Southern cause, which is kind of perverse, but that was actually taken in part out of that little section of the Second Inaugural. So in many ways, I mean, we don't know what the Second Inaugural might have done had Lincoln lived. It's one of the many things we don't know what might have happened had Lincoln lived. But in the aftermath of his death, the Second Inaugural was taken in ways that he never would have intended.
Interesting. So the Southerners, some of them were saying, go easy on us?
Exactly. I mean, it's a kind of, let's forget about all of this and let's just get back to work. Well, what that meant in the long run was, basically selling out Southern blacks, eventually disenfranchising them and imposing Jim Crow. And leading Frederick Douglass, actually, to say as early as the 1880s that emancipation, as Lincoln had envisioned it, has not occurred. I mean, the Southern blacks are not truly free. Well, in some ways, one of the images of Lincoln that came out during that period was as a guy who was not vindictive, and not being vindictive meant let the South go alone, and we all know where that led.
Mm-hmm. You brought up Douglass. Let's talk about him for a moment. Were they friends? Was Lincoln inspired by Douglass's quote radicalism, mm-hmm. and moved to take on more of an anti-slavery position or not?
Well, no. I mean, they were friends. Let's go back. I mean, friends. They called each other friends. They met on three occasions. Douglass came to the White House twice, and then just after the second inaugural address, which Douglass attended the ceremony, Douglass shows up at the White House and is turned away at first, and then Lincoln has him come in and says very nice things about him. They were two important people, but very, very different. I mean, Frederick Douglass was the leading black abolitionist in the country by the time of the Civil War, and therefore one of the leading abolitionists in the country, a very eloquent, very powerful slave who had run away, a fugitive slave, ex-slave, who had run away to the North and become an important abolitionist figure. And he was an agitator. He was something of a radical. And he pushed and he pushed and he pushed. Lincoln, who one colleague of mine says was just as opposed to slavery as Frederick Douglass was in his way, but Abraham Lincoln was a politician, as I said at the start. Was president of the United States. His responsibility is to the entire country, which then consisted basically of the North, although he didn't see it that way. But he had political responsibilities as a president, which were different from that of a radical agitator. Now, there are those who think that Lincoln was much more conservative than he was, because at times Abraham Lincoln wanted to appear to be more conservative than he was. He was a cagey political actor. He wanted to make sure that those people who were in the North who did not go as far as he did on slavery issues were not going to turn against him. He needed them on his side in order to win the war. So he moves and shakes and has all sorts of concerns, which are not those of Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass gets very angry at various of his positions, tries to push him harder. I don't think that it was Douglass's words that changed Lincoln so much as the political situation. In some ways, in fact, I think Lincoln brought Douglass on board. Douglass, you know, eventually comes out to be a great admirer of Lincoln's at various points, more than Douglass convinced Lincoln. But it's a kind of an interesting interplay between the two of them, because you know, have the radical on the one hand and the president on the other, and their views or their actions do converge at one point, but I don't think it's because one convinced the other.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest, and we'll take them in a moment. If you've seen the new edition of The New Republic, just in your mailbox yesterday, I believe, if you get it at home, the cover story is on Abraham Lincoln, The New Republic's July cover story, who Lincoln was and who he wasn't. And the author of this wonderful piece, very extensive, and what he's done is taken a look, a very deep look at a lot of the Lincoln scholarship, the many, many books that have come out during this bicentennial year, and examined them, and says that not enough is said by historians about the political astuteness of Abraham Lincoln, that we concentrate on his literary works as well we should, because they're gorgeous and they're important and speak to human ideals. But we also ought to look at Lincoln the politician, because he was not always successful in what he said, and a lot of what he said was to achieve a political goal. He also has some interesting things to say about how Obama has used Lincoln pretty masterfully, I would say. Well, here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, we've been real low on emails this week. I don't know why. I assume the system is working. But you could send an email, and we'll see if it's working. Talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our guest is Professor Sean Wilentz. He teaches at Princeton University. He's written extensively on politics, including The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln. His recent book is on the Age of Reagan, History, 1974 to 2008. And he's currently completing a book, this guy's a lot of interest, tentatively entitled Bob Dylan in America, a historical and cultural interpretation of Dylan's life and work. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, librarian extraordinaire Nancy Pearl will be joining us. Okay, let's go to phone calls. Our lines are filled. Lots of interest in Abraham Lincoln among those of you who listen to this program. And may I say this, that we are greatly looking forward to our trip to Springfield in October. You responded to that trip in great numbers right off the bat. So we're on our way. We're going to have a good time. And we're going to have a Lincoln historian with us on that trip as well, a couple of them, actually. Andrew is our first caller from Ashland. Hi, Andrew.
Oh, hi. I'm reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's book currently on Lincoln, and this show reminded me of an interesting part I got to about the Emancipation Proclamation. And it seems from the reading of that book that the real impetus for that was Lincoln's concern about the amount of help that the Confederacy was getting from slaves, and thought that the emancipation would undermine that to some extent. Just the logistics that the slaves were providing the Confederacy, he was concerned, was allowing the Confederacy to succeed in the war. And it seemed to me in my reading of it that his cabinet kind of held that same perspective. It sounds like the War Secretary Stanton was very much in favor of the proclamation, mostly because of that logistical military reason, and not so much a moral reason at all. At least that's my reading of the deliberations that they had in the cabinet about the emancipation.
Yeah, well, Andrew, that's an important point. Certainly, Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, was pushing even more than Lincoln on the issues of both emancipation and the recruitment of black troops for the war. The point that you're making is right. I mean, to the extent that it was clear from very early on in the war, as clear as the first Battle of Bull Run, not that long after Fort Sumter, that the Confederate cause was being aided because they could take slaves and have them do work for them, therefore liberating lots of poorer whites to fight for the Confederate cause. So that was a factor, and they realized that very early on in the war. And down the line, that was an argument that was made by Lincoln in order to justify emancipation as a military necessity, which is the way that he did justify, particularly to get more conservative Northerners on his side. But I don't think that it meant that Lincoln had no moral view of what was going on, or that he wasn't intensely anti-slavery, or that he didn't see emancipation as a moral act. In fact, there's a couple of words in the Emancipation Proclamation that show that he does. The point is that Lincoln had been trying to find ways to get rid of slavery within the Constitution of the United States. He, unlike the more radical abolitionists, could not see a way to do it. He did not want to destroy slavery while destroying the Constitution. He didn't think that that would be a victory at all. So he begins, as president, once the war breaks out, he begins with a bunch of schemes for what he called compensated emancipation, which was sort of the way people thought it was going to happen, if it was going to happen at all, within the states where slavery already existed. He tries a scheme in Delaware. He tried a scheme in Kentucky. It doesn't work out. By early 1862, it was fairly clear that compensated emancipation is not going to happen. It's then that he begins to think about emancipation under his role as commander-in-chief of the American military. And to the powers under which he can do this. So it's a complicated interplay. I wouldn't say it's either military issues or military logistics versus morality. I think the two went together, but he was trying to find a way to justify emancipation once he realized that compensated emancipation wasn't going to work.
Mm-hmm. And what about this team of rivals? You talk about the fact that the cabinet was not a stellar choice. There were problems with his selections.
Well, I mean, I think the idea that, it can be easily exaggerated, the idea of the team of rivals. In some ways, it wasn't so much of a team, and there was certainly a lot of rivalry going on there. The idea that a president, any president, should try to pick for his cabinet people from around his own political party in particular and outside of his party as well to serve him for political reasons and for other reasons. He wants to get a lot of different forms of advice. That's an old one. I mean, that goes back a long ways. It goes back before Lincoln. Lincoln didn't invent that, particularly with regard to Secretary of State, actually. It's interesting. There's a historical convergence. But the idea of picking your main political rival as Secretary of State goes all the way back to John Quincy Adams in the 1820s. Lincoln happened to have a good one. His political rival happened to be a very able man named William Henry Seward, who served him eventually served him well, although at the beginning of the administration, Seward tried to take Lincoln over. But that eventually worked out. But other choices wasn't so great. I mean, Salmon Chase, who was Secretary of the Treasury, ended up by 1864 trying to snatch the nomination away from Abraham Lincoln. Edward Bates complained, who was Attorney General, complained that Lincoln never took the cabinet's advice seriously enough. Simon Cameron from Pennsylvania, who was a Paul, who kind of helped Lincoln get the nomination at the convention in Chicago in 1860, he was corrupt. I mean, he was corrupt as the day is long, and eventually there were political differences between them as well. He had to be kind of eased out of office. It was then, actually, that Edwin Stanton, the great Edwin Stanton, came in at the beginning of 1862 to become Secretary of War. But he was a Democrat. He wasn't a rival in any sense of Lincoln's at all. He was maybe the most able cabinet member, but he doesn't quite fit that rubric. So I think that it's been kind of overdone. It's kind of exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln was a very shrewd political operator, no question about it. But, even the shrewdest of political operators, things don't always work out, and that was true for the cabinet as well.
Mike from Menominee Falls, hi.
Yes, I had a question. I was viewing the original record of the census of 1860 and 1850, and it showed, I can't remember which one it was, but it showed Abraham Lincoln listed along with everyone else,
huh?
And anybody can find this at the library, but it had two people. It had a young man named Johnson, that's his last name, and a young girl that were living in his household. The girl was a servant. Do you know anything about that?
I don't, but it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, by the time Abraham Lincoln, certainly by 1860. He was a very successful lawyer. He had come back from a very frustrating term as in the U.S. Congress in 47 to 49, actually, and came back to Springfield thinking that his political career was over. He was somewhat bitter about that, and just came back to be a lawyer with his partner, William Herndon. But he earned a lot of money, and he had a very nice house in Springfield. And, yes, he certainly would have had servants in the household. I don't know the details about that, but it doesn't surprise me.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. We go to Casey from Green Bay next. Hi, Casey.
How are you doing today?
Okay, how are you?
Wonderful.
Good.
I'd like to ask your speaker how important it was for him to select, Lincoln to select Andrew Johnson as vice presidential candidate.
Yeah.
Concerning Johnson was from Tennessee, it was the only southern state that was pro-Union during the Civil War, and how Johnson carried out Lincoln's policies after he was assassinated, and it also got him impeached by the northern politicians. The northern politicians wanted vengeance. They did not want to follow Lincoln's plan about how everybody was supposed to come together again after the Civil War, and Johnson really had to implement Lincoln's plan, and it also got him impeached by the northern politicians. And how important it was for Johnson to try to do what Lincoln wanted to do before he was assassinated.
Well, Casey, you know, you raise a number of different points. First of all, yes, in 1864, Lincoln, who, as I say, public opinion was not particularly on his side. He had beaten back a radical challenge from Salmon Chase on his left, and defeated the radicals, got them off his back. But he also had to appeal to more conservative Northerners, and he did so by bringing Andrew Johnson on board. Many around him thought that Johnson was not particularly an able man, but Lincoln liked him. He was a Democrat. He had been a Democrat, but he was a loyal Democrat. He was from a border state. All of these recommended Andrew Johnson to Lincoln very, very highly. And it all worked out. I mean, in the end, Lincoln ended up winning that election in 1864, which, as I say, for a long time looked like it wasn't going to happen. So again, this is Lincoln very much the politician, the political calculator, trying to figure things out. Now, as for Reconstruction, what happened thereafter, it's unclear to me. I think it was unclear to Lincoln exactly what his Reconstruction plans would be. I mean, he had a number of different. He said a number of different things. The war, you remember, was just coming to an end, or just ended, when he was assassinated. But he had plans that some of the radicals in the Congress thought were too soft. He also, however, was talking about things like limited black suffrage in the South, which got conservatives very angry. In fact, they got one Southern, not sympathizer, but actually a Confederate actor named John Wilkes Booth, so angry when he heard it that he went out and basically assassinated him or executed him at Ford's Theater in April 1865. So Lincoln's own views, I think, were incoherent in a sense. He was just trying to figure it out. Johnson, however, I don't know if I agree that Johnson simply carried out Lincoln's ideas, because the idea of how you bring the country together again, well, there are a lot of different ways of thinking about that. The problem that Johnson had was that he was working pretty much hand in glove with ex-Confederates after 1865, or after 1866, certainly. He takes a position that is very, very favorable to the old slaveholding class in the South. Why he would do so, it was odd, because he had been very anti-planter. He was very much a man of the yeomanry, of the poor farmer class. He himself had, was a tailor. In eastern Tennessee, a very anti-planter group. But he did not want to see the end of slavery necessarily at all bring equality between whites and blacks. And in doing so, with those feelings, he ran into problems with Congress, with the radicals in Congress, but also, you know, moderates in Congress. And there's, you know, basically the whole thing kind of fell apart. And in the end, he was impeached, although he was saved from being removed from office by the slenderest of margins. But, you know, the fact was that in the aftermath of the Civil War, the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, resistance to any kind of peaceable working out of how you go about what political rights and civil rights would be for the freedmen in the South, how they were to be worked out, that continued to be fought over intensely. the rise in the South of groups like the Ku Klux Klan in 1866, right after the war. This wasn't going to be taken care of until U.S. Grant was elected president after Johnson. So the Johnson presidency, I don't know if you could say that it was Lincoln's plan put into effect. I think it was just a product of, in some ways, an ironic byproduct of Lincoln's political choice to choose him as vice president in 1864.
Isn't that interesting that he felt that he had to choose this guy to win the election, and then his vision, or at least what people saw as his vision, gets totally messed up by Johnson, that he just can't handle Reconstruction, such an important time in American history.
Well, Kathleen, that's the ironies of history are enormous, but you can't understand history without a sense of irony.
I mean, right.
You need that right at the heart.
Yeah. Well, our phone number is 800-486-8655, and if you'd like to send an email, you can do that. It's talk@WPR.org. We're talking about the fascinating cover story of the New Republic, just released, Who Lincoln Was and Was Not, The Images and Illusions of This Momentous Bicentennial Year. The author of the piece is with us, who's also a Lincoln scholar, and he is Professor Sean Wilentz. He is in the Social and Political History Department at where he teaches that in the Political History at Princeton University. And he has written a lot. His most recent book is on The Age of Reagan, 1974 to 2008, Reconsideration of U.S. Politics Since the Watergate Affair. And he's also the author of The Rise of American Democracy, Jefferson to Lincoln, 2005. And he is now working, remind me to ask him about this at the end of this interview, working on a book, Bob Dylan in America, Historical and Cultural Interpretation of Dylan's Life and Work. We have some lines open. Join us if you'd like, and we'll take more calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nancy Pearl is with us, the second hour of our program, with book recommendations, and she has a new project, actually. She wants you to take a survey, and she has a number of other librarians and librarians in training working with her to give you, if you answer a certain survey, specific recommendations of books that you would like. It's a great project. So actually, why don't you take the survey now? You can listen to us and take the survey. Go to WPR.org, and there's a thing that says Kathleen Dunn somewhere there. And then you go to that, and it's a survey she's asking you to take. And then your answers will be compiled, and your book recommendations will be forthcoming. That's great, huh? Here's our number for you to talk about Lincoln, 800-486-8655. And our guest is Professor Sean Wilentz. And our next caller is Claire from Germantown. Hi, Claire.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I lived in Greenville, Florida, home of Ray Charles, from 1992 to 2000. I went to a book club in Madison. That's the capital of the county. Okay, there's an old bookstore there. Mrs. Cherry runs it. And I bought a book. I know there were only a couple left. They were tattered, but I bought one of all the sermons Lincoln listened to while he was president. Mm-hmm. And it's somewhere around my house. I don't know. I can't find it. Professor, do you know of that book?
I do know of that book, and it's interesting. There was one particular minister I mentioned actually in the review, who was the minister at the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church in Washington. And Lincoln was not a particularly churchy guy. He did not go to church a great deal until in 1862. He and his wife Mary would go to church more often. It was in the aftermath of the devastating death of their young son Willie. He went to the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church a fair amount, much more often. And the minister there was a very powerful guy. Actually, he was at the Princeton Theological Seminary. That's where he was trained. So I take some credit for him here in Princeton. And he had a particular view of providence and of the trying to understand or comprehend the incomprehensible. In the face of, how to face the incomprehensible. And Lincoln took a great interest in this, from an intellectual as much as a spiritual angle. And it's pretty clear to me that that had, you know, some influence on Lincoln's thinking, and certainly on his prose, because he gets even more King James Bible-y by the time he writes the second inaugural. But yes, there's a very interesting book, very interesting sermons, a very interesting aspect of Lincoln's life.
Mm-hmm.
You're in Illinois?
What's that, Claire? I'm sorry.
I'm trying to find the book. I can't find it in my house.
I'm sorry.
Sorry about that.
We don't know how to help you, Claire.
Oh, okay.
But it'll show up because you've called us, and somehow it's going to show up today.
It's good. Thank you. Good vibes.
Yeah, good vibes. Thanks, Claire, very much for the call. It's the kind of book you'd like to find, right?
And absolutely.
She wants to read it this afternoon. You did a whole lot of reading of the books that gave you a chance this bicentennial time to look a lot at what's been published recently. What, in preparation for our Lincoln trip, what do you recommend, Sean?
What should you read?
What should we read? Of all that you've read, what did you like best?
Well, you know, of all the biographies of Lincoln, the one that I think stands up the best is still one. It's about 20 years old. It's less than that. Published in 1995 by the historian David Herbert Donald.
Mm-hmm.
It has flaws to it, I think. It makes Lincoln out to be a little bit too passive, in my view. But it has extraordinary coverage of his political career in particular. And it's a well-written scholarly, but well-written biography. I like Ronald White's biography as well of Lincoln. It's a little bit more accessible. It's a little bit more on the surface, I think, than the Donald. But it's good, too, if you want to get a scope of the entire life. But, you know, to really understand Lincoln, I would also, there's nothing, no substitute for reading the man himself, to read the Lincoln-Douglas debates through, to read some of those great speeches, including the ones during the campaign of 1860. And that stuff is all easily accessible on the web, and so you can even get it for free.
Which is great. Let's talk about Obama for a moment. I must say that I think this guy is a pretty masterful politician, and
yep.
You write at the end of your great article, The New Republic, about Obama and how he really knew how to highlight those Lincoln connections,
sure.
Didn't he?
Sure. Well, But the irony, again, the irony is that people read into the president a kind of post-partisan, post-political, trans-political side, which, I mean, he uses that to his advantage, too, which is fine. But it shows just how Lincolnian he is, not because he transcends politics, but because he's such a great politician. And that's the point I try to make at the end. He's Lincolnian for all the reasons that many of his admirers think he's not. They kind of beatify Lincoln into this transcendent figure and try to make the president into the same kind of figure. In my view, Lincoln's a very down-to-earth guy, and so is President Obama, and they have similar political skills. They also both happen to be skinny, and they both happen to be from Illinois, and they both have sort of big ears. But yes, no question that the president and his handlers or his advisors used the connection. I mean, he opened his campaign for the presidency in Springfield. He cited Lincoln a lot. Any Illinois politician would. This is not surprising. What's interesting to me is the way that certain kinds of intellectuals kind of bought into this, what should we say, beatification both of Lincoln and of the president, in ways that, you know, certainly helped Obama's cause and has resounded even to this day, but don't tell us much either about the president or about Lincoln, because it's in the world of fantasy rather than the world of reality.
Hmm. And does that say something about, what does that say about us, that we need this world of fantasy? There's greatness, a huge amount of greatness in Lincoln. Why is it that we can't look at him as in his entirety?
Well, I mean, I think that particularly for liberals these days, on the liberal side of the political spectrum, I think there's been a hunger for some kind of leadership. There's been a hunger for 40 years for the kind of, you know, spine-tingling leadership that really had passed away with Robert Kennedy in 1968. And I think that both for the older generation, but then the younger generation as well, they fastened on to President Obama as just that kind of figure, you know, as a kind of liberal savior. You know, much as on the conservative side, Ronald Reagan has some of those qualities now. You know, now that he's gone, everybody wants to try and recapture the greatness that was Ronald Reagan as they saw it. And I think people do need or want a kind of mythic leadership from time to time, and I think a good politician knows how to use that. Certainly in his own time, Abraham Lincoln was not that kind of person, however. I mean, Abraham Lincoln was roundly criticized. You know, he was not a transcendent figure at all. People called him a baboon. They called him the monkey. They called him all kinds of things because they thought that he was a political manipulator, that he was not being straight, that they just didn't like him for one reason or another. It was only after his assassination that he ascended to become this kind of Christ-like figure. The fact that he was assassinated on Good Friday kind of
right.
helped that along. But it was only in the aftermath of the war that he became, you know, the apotheosis of Lincoln began. President Obama came in having picked, having had the benefit of that apotheosis, and so far he has managed to keep that going. But ultimately, his presidency will rise or fall not on whether he is Abraham Lincoln or whether he is FDR or what have you, but whether you know he does a good job in and of himself. Let me add: I mean, there's no question the fact that, that the first African American president would be. Would bring to mind Abraham Lincoln.
Sure.
I mean, that's only natural, right? I mean, of course, and it's an historic and an extraordinary thing. But as he himself has said, look, okay, now he's president, and he's going to be, you know, his historical reputation, let alone his political reputation, will rise and fall or fall on the basis of what he does as president and how successful he is. All the Abraham Lincoln memorabilia in the world won't change that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Alice from Milwaukee. Hi, Alice.
Hello, good morning. I'd like to know that if Lincoln had any contact in any way with Louis Braille, who was also born in 1809, in January, actually, of that year, and we're celebrating his bicentennial, of course, as well. And he was, of course, not only making Braille a part, or what we today call Braille in his honor, a part of the School for the Blind in Paris, France, and eventually, of course, all of that came into the United States through the French-speaking people of New Orleans and St. Louis. And I wonder if there's any evidence there of Lincoln's contact with Louis Braille as a teacher.
Well, you've stumped me. I don't know the answer to that question. I have never read of any connection, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't one there. You know, someone else was actually born. There's a lot of bicentennials this year. Charles Darwin was born exactly
right.
the same day as Abraham Lincoln on February 12th, 1809. So there's been a fair amount of written about that similarity, although I'm not so sure that it's so similar. But at any rate, because in fact Darwin's writings only came in after Lincoln was dead, but it became, you know, important. But Lincoln was a man who was, you know, interested in all kinds of scientific and technological gadgetry and inventions that would improve the life of mankind. He actually had a patent, I think, himself. So, you know, so Lincoln is something of a tinkerer, something of a self-taught mechanic, a kind of amateur, you know, amateur scientist on his own. And he certainly would have if I would imagine that if he knew much about Louis Braille, he would have thought that he was a great man, because certainly there was a technological breakthrough that increased the possibilities for those who had been left out to be included in the world of literacy, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute left, so we got to talk about Bob Dylan for a moment.
Okay.
Go from Abe to Bob.
Sure.
You are the historian in residence at his official website.
Yes.
How's the book coming along?
The book is, I'm writing it right now. I'm almost done. It'll be out next summer.
Oh.
Yeah.
And how do you go from where you've been to where you are with Bob Dylan? What's the Bob Dylan interest?
Boy, that's a long story. But, I mean, I see them all as a piece, because it's all me, I guess. I grew up in Greenwich, or my father had a bookshop in Greenwich Village. So I was, you know, a part of that whole world of poets and writers and songwriters, et cetera, from a very early age. And I was certainly a Bob Dylan fan from a very early age. The first concert I heard of his was back in 1964, and I won't tell you how old I was, but I was very, very young. And so I've been a you know, I've loved his music, but I think that that Dylan's work is so important to the history of American culture and reflects American culture going all the way back to the Civil War, in fact, and before, that he was a character worth writing about, quite apart from my own enjoyment of his work.
Yeah, well, we look forward to seeing it. Thank you so much. Thanks for the article and all the work that went into it and your insights. It's been a great hour, and thank you.
Well, thank you, Kathleen, for having me.
Uh-huh. Our great pleasure. Professor Sean Wilentz, the article is the cover story of the current issue of the New Republic. It's pretty long. You can read it online because it's online as well. And he looks at Abraham Lincoln as a politician, and the fact that he was politically astute is nothing to be ashamed of. And historians ought to concentrate on that aspect of his life as well. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. And thank you, everybody, for your calls. We're sure looking forward to going to Springfield. We're going to have fun. Well, we'll be back following the news on the Ideas Network.